Michael Freddie Braun was never the man you saw pulling the trigger, but nearly every bullet that shattered peace across Spanish Town, Maypen, and Kingston had his fingerprints on it. He didn't boast like the Dons, didn't run for political cover, and didn't want his name in the streets. He moved in whispers, on the docks at midnight, in the rusted hulls of containers that bled war into Jamaica's veins. While politicians gave speeches about crime, Freddie was slipping AK-47s into the hands of 16-year-olds. While mothers wept over their sons, he was banking U.S. dollars from a gun pipeline stretching from Miami to Clarendon. And when the bodies piled up and the gangs grew bold, everyone asked who was supplying the fire, but no one could name him until it was too late. This is the story of Jamaica's most elusive arms trafficker, a ghost in the bloodbath, a merchant of silence, and a man whose death came only after the damage was already done. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. A ghost in the crossfire. They called him Freddie, not out of familiarity, but because that was all anyone really knew. To police, he was Michael Braun. To the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, ATF, he was an unknown node on a complex chart linking Jamaican gang violence to American gun stores. But in Spanish Town and Maypen, his legend whispered louder than his name. The first time investigators even caught wind of Freddie, it was through a 223 round, lodged in a cinder block wall in Riverton City. The casing was marked in a way that tied it to a known shipment of weapons that had gone missing from a Florida warehouse months earlier. Jamaican police took note, but had no suspect, no eyewitness, and no reason to believe the gun wasn't just another trafficked firearm among thousands flooding the island. But on the street, among gunmen and gang lieutenants, the phrase Freddie Gear began to surface. It meant top-shelf firepower, Russian rifles, Glocks with converted full auto switches, even American-made M4s. No gang on the rise could stay relevant without tapping into the elusive stream of metal and death that Freddie provided. The origins. Spanish Town's arms broker. Michael Braun grew up in Spanish Town during the 1970s, when political violence was consuming Jamaica. The country was being torn in two by rival political factions who armed their loyalists to defend garrisons, intimidate opposition, and secure votes. Freddie, just a teenager, saw firsthand what a gun could do, not just to a man, but to a community. What made him different was that he never wanted to pull the trigger. He wanted to own the trigger. Even as a youth, he was drawn not to power for power's sake, but to control from behind the scenes. In his 20s, Freddie started out small, helping local dons transport hardware, as guns were euphemistically called. He ran errands between Maypen and Portmore, managing drop-offs and pickups in exchange for cash. But he didn't stay a middleman for long. While others were addicted to turf wars and easy kills, Freddie had a long-term vision. Dominate the supply chain. The American connection. In 1993, Freddie made his first trip to the U.S. using a false passport, reportedly arranged through an underground network tied to a Florida-based Jamaican expat. He stayed in Miami Gardens and began building connections among the small-time hustlers and legal gun purchasers who frequented pawn shops and gun shows. Using a mix of straw buyers and false paperwork, Freddie began acquiring semi-automatic rifles, handguns, and conversion kits. The brilliance of his operation was in the volume. It wasn't flashy. It was systematic. Legal purchases, slight modifications, hidden compartments in used car engines and refrigerator crates, all routed through third-party freight services bound for Jamaica's south coast. By 1997, entire neighborhoods in Clarendon were being outfitted with American weapons. And Freddie, he was living like a ghost. No pictures, no criminal record in the U.S., no arrests in Jamaica. Just a name, pass between gang leaders like a sacred contact. Murders with no fingerprints. The violence that followed was unlike anything Jamaica had seen. The infamous Klansman One Order feud in Spanish Town, which left over 1,000 dead between 2000 and 2010, was fueled in part by weapons that ballistic experts later trace back to the same U.S. serial ranges Freddie was sourcing. But Freddie never attended a single gang meeting, never claimed affiliation with any don. He was, as one senior cop said, a silent arms dealer for every side. His most dangerous talent wasn't smuggling. It was neutrality. Freddie didn't pick favorites. He sold to gangs in Denham Town 1 week, then to rivals in Trench Town the next. He provided airdrop-style crates to Clarendon gangs through abandoned cane fields. In return, he got paid in U.S. dollars, stored cash in concrete slabs, and kept his true residence shifting between rural outposts in Manchester and St. Catherine. No police raid ever found him. No photos. No fingerprints. No wiretaps ever caught his voice. The operation cracks. It wasn't the Jamaican police who first made a dent. It was the ATF. In 2005, a sting operation in Miami led to the arrest of three straw buyers caught attempting to purchase 60 handguns in 1 day. Under pressure, one of them gave up a name, Michael Brown, but it wasn't enough. No address, no known alias, just he's Jamaican and pays in cash. Around the same time, a gang war erupted in Maypen. One evening in 2006, seven bodies were found riddled with bullets near a construction site. The scene showed the use of two M4 carbines and a Glock 17 modified for rapid fire. These were not weapons you'd find in an average criminal stash. These were military-grade tools of annihilation. And Jamaican police began to whisper what the gunmen already knew. Freddie was escalating. The politicians knew, but stayed silent. Rumors swirled that certain high-level politicians were aware of Freddie's existence. He was too big to hide, but like so many aspects of Jamaican crime, he thrived in the gray zone between corruption and convenience. Sources close to the investigation later claim Freddie was allowed to operate because he was orderly. He didn't kill civilians. He kept violence within acceptable limits, and he paid the right people. The trade-off: political calm during elections, armed control of volatile districts, and plausible deniability if things went wrong. But by 2009, things were spiraling. A new wave of younger gangsters, more violent, more reckless, were misusing the same weapons Freddie once sold with quiet intent. Innocents were being caught in the crossfire, and the pressure to act was growing. Final moves in the shadows. Freddie sensed the net closing. According to one informant, Freddie began shutting down his U.S. connections in late 2010. He sold off his Miami safe house, transferred funds to a bank in Panama, and began limiting his contact to only two trusted couriers in Jamaica. He relocated from Spanish Town to a secluded farm in Manchester, where he raised goats and lived under a fake name. But even then, he couldn't stop. In 2011, an intercepted container of industrial plumbing supplies revealed a hidden cache, 14 rifles and 9 pistols. The customs tag traced back to a company in Georgia, one tied to Freddie. It was the beginning of the end. The trap is set. The final blow came in 2012. A wiretap authorized jointly by the ATF and Jamaican Major Organized Crime and Anti-Corruption Agency, MACA, captured a voice presumed to be Freddie's. It was grainy, but the context was clear. He was arranging a new drop in Salt River, Clarendon. Police moved fast. They planned the operation for 3 months. Informants were placed. Surveillance drones were deployed. And finally, on a humid August night, they moved in. Freddie's convoy never made it to the drop. Somewhere between Williamsfield and Toll Gate, a police roadblock forced his SUV to a halt. He ran into the bush, gun in hand, but not to fire, to vanish. Shots rang out. No one knows who fired first. But when the dust settled, Michael Freddie Brown was lying face down in a thicket of ferns. dead from a single shot to the chest. Next to him, an American-made Glock, serial number filed off. No one claimed him. No family buried him. And just like that, the ghost supplier was gone. Chapter 2. The guns that outlived a man. When the dust settled over the hills of Manchester, and Michael Freddie Brown's body lay cooling in the Jamaican bush, police thought they'd closed the door on an era, but they were wrong. Freddie's death didn't end the bloodshed. It revealed just how deep the damage ran. Because Freddie wasn't just a man, he was a system. And when systems collapse, they don't go quietly. The public announcement of his death came 3 days after the raid. A short press release. No photo. No dramatic arrest footage. Just a confirmation. The man suspected of orchestrating a years-long gun smuggling operation between the United States and Jamaica was dead. No funeral. No family stepping forward. His name never made national headlines. He vanished from life the same way he operated in it, quietly. But in the weeks that followed, the streets told a different story. The ripple effect in the streets. Within 2 weeks of Freddie's death, the gun markets in Spanish Town and Maypen dried up. Literally overnight, the supply chain broke. Gangs that had grown used to receiving monthly shipments of Glocks, Tech-9s, and AR-15s suddenly found themselves outgunned. Prices for bullets tripled. Gun rental schemes, where a weapon could be borrowed for a hit and return, became increasingly desperate and violent. More shockingly, mid-level gang enforcers turned on one another. Freddie had played a delicate balancing act, ensuring no one faction grew too dominant. But with him gone, paranoia bloomed. Who would take over? Who knew his roots, his contacts, his drop points? Bodies began dropping not because of rivalries, but because everyone was afraid someone else held the key to Freddie's empire. Weapons with no expiration date, investigators expected a calm after his death. What they found was worse. In the 6 months after Freddie was killed, Jamaican homicide rates increased in certain parishes. Why? Because the weapons he'd smuggled in over the years were still active, and now completely unregulated. In Denham Town, a converted Uzi was used to kill two off-duty police officers. The weapon was traced to a 2007 Miami shipment that Freddie had allegedly coordinated. In Montego Bay, a nightclub shooting left 4 dead and 9 wounded. The recovered shell casings matched a batch of ammunition brought in through the port of Kingston in 2010. Freddie's legacy wasn't just in the men he armed. It was in the guns themselves. They were durable, modified, untraceable, and still very much in circulation. The unspoken conspiracy behind closed doors. Members of Jamaica's law enforcement agencies began admitting something few dared say out loud. Freddie had helped maintain control. Not peace, not justice, but a fragile, brutal balance. He operated like a shadow state, arming everyone just enough to keep. A level playing field. Dons respected him because he never betrayed. Politicians tolerated him because he didn't draw headlines. Even some senior cops admitted off record that Freddie's existence kept violence predictable. With his death, that predictability vanished. Turf wars grew reckless. Guns were now falling into the hands of younger, less disciplined gang members with no code and no memory of the old arrangements. Entire districts erupted into shootouts over rumors because no one controlled the flow anymore. Freddie wasn't a peacemaker, but he had been a firewall, and now he was gone. The money trail. After his death, Mocha launched a deep financial probe into accounts believed to be tied to Freddie's operations. It led to more questions than answers. Investigators discovered 3 offshore shell companies, one in Panama, one in the British Virgin Islands, and another in Cyprus, all connected to a dormant Jamaican export business. The company hadn't shipped a single item in 5 years, yet bank records show over $3.2 million USD passed through its accounts between 2008 and 2012. That money was laundered through real estate purchases in Jamaica. 3 homes, two of which were never lived in, a farm bought in Mandeville, a fleet of trucks registered to a fake construction company. But the biggest shock came from the U.S. side. The ATF revealed Freddy's network had acquired at least 640 firearms over a 10-year span, many purchased legally, and then disappeared. Their paperwork vanished, serial numbers filed off. Police now estimate that only 30% of those guns have been recovered. The rest, still out there. Freddy's apprentices. Freddy didn't die without passing the torch, or trying to. In 2013, 1 year after his death, a young man named Andre Silk Richards was arrested at Norman Manley International Airport with blueprints for a gun conversion device hidden inside his luggage. He was 25, clean record, college educated. Under interrogation, Silk admitted to working under a silent partner for the past 3 years. Investigators believe that partner was Freddy. Silk had been mentored, trained to move quietly, launder smarter, and use technology Freddy never needed. Silk claimed the next phase would involve 3D printing parts to avoid detection altogether. The new wave of arms traffickers wasn't going to rely on smuggling crates and bribing customs. They were going digital. Freddy's ghost was evolving. The families left behind. While media and politicians rarely mentioned Freddy by name, the victims of the violence he fueled were everywhere, and they remembered. In Clarendon, Dolores James still lives two houses down from where her son was gunned down by a high-powered rifle in 2010. She didn't know who pulled the trigger, but she knew the type of gun used because she'd seen a similar one on a police display on TV. She'd written letters to Parliament demanding to know how so many American weapons ended up in her community. She never got a response. In Spanish Town, Father Gideon Rowe runs a youth shelter named Hands Without Guns. He remembers the exact day Freddy died, not because he knew the man, but because the violence in his parish shifted. It became more erratic, he says. Before, it was like every killer had a mission. Now, they just shoot to send a message. He doesn't glorify Freddy, but he fears what came after. A devil with rules is still a devil, but when he's gone, the wild devils come out. The official denial machine. Despite the mounting evidence of Freddy's impact, the Jamaican government has never publicly released a full report on his operations. There's no documentary, no public commission, no monument to the damage. Some say it's because his operations implicated too many powerful people, corrupt customs officers, politicians who turned a blind eye, businessmen who took blood money to store crates in their warehouses. Others say it's because acknowledging him would be admitting the truth. Jamaica's crime epidemic was never just about bad men with guns. It was about systems that let those guns in. Systems run by men who wore suits, not ski masks. Freddy's silence wasn't just strategic. It was protective. He knew too much. And when a man like that dies quietly, everyone stays quiet with him. Where the guns sleep today, the guns Freddy brought in still turn up at crime scenes. A Glock in Old Harbor, a rifle in Tivoli, a modified submachine gun in West Kingston. Police catalog them. Forensics trace their origins. Journalists write stories. But none of it brings the dead back. None of it undoes the decades-long damage caused by one man's supply chain. The irony? Freddy was never a killer. He didn't shoot anyone. Never pulled a gun in public. Never posted photos with rifles like the Dons do today. But he enabled them all. He was the skeleton key to a nation's darkest closet. Final truths. When you study the legacy of Michael Freddy Brown, one fact becomes unavoidable. He didn't create Jamaica's gun problem. He just perfected it. He understood the gaps between borders, the loopholes in laws, the price of silence, and the desperation of men who believed a gun could fix their lives. He filled a demand, fed a war, and in doing so, became a legend, built not on headlines, but on havoc. Jamaica has had many Dons, many killers, many monsters. But Freddy, he was something rarer. He was the ghost who gave them their teeth. And long after his body turned to dust, the war he fueled still burns.